It's a great pleasure to welcome Charlotte Johnson here. Charlotte has a very interesting background. I was learning she spent 7 years making advocacy films for international development NGOs in Africa and Asia, all around the world. Then she joined the Bartlett, the Faculty of Built Environment at UCL, trying to map UCL's research expertise in urban sustainability. She was awarded a public engagement fellowship to look at the role of the public in energy policy research, which is something near and dear to my heart. She again built up a number of projects with local authorities, not-for-profit groups. And in November 2015, she joined the engineering faculty to work on the Engineering Comes Home co-design project, and works on a number of projects now across the Bartlett School of Environment, Energy, and Resources, I guess that's what it's called, using ethnography and other qualitative research methods to look at infrastructure in the home. And our respondent is Dr. Paul Ward, who's a reader in environmental history and the Faculty of History here. Most of you will know Paul. He's done a number of interesting books and range of issues, environmental, economic, and social history, early and modern Europe. I'd particularly highlight the couple of new books he has. Paul doesn't aim low, he aims kind of very broadly. So one book is on the intellectual history of sustainability from 1500 to 1870, and another on the history of the concept of the environment, and its politicization and institutionalization during the 20th century. So I look forward to to delving into those in due course. He's also doing some co-editing of a book that we all know on good energy policy. Without further ado, let me turn the floor over to Charlotte, just to say, in terms of our seminars coming up, we have, as I said, in 2 weeks' time, our kind of group meeting. Then 2 weeks after that, before the end of term, we have Julius Weitzdorfer from the Faculty of Law talking about Fukushima and the law. He's done a lot of work on nuclear power. And then there probably is another seminar in here somewhere in the Easter term, but at least on May 6th, we have Professor Guy Liu from Peking University HSBC Business School talking about electricity market reform in China. So mark those in your diaries, and then I'll turn the floor over. There should be a sheet circulating, sign-up sheet circulating for those interested, those who haven't signed up yet, and also, again, if you have other ideas for themes or speakers. Great. I'll just turn that over to you, Charlotte.
Thank you. Yep, so I'm Charlotte. I'm a researcher at UCL's Energy Institute, which is in the Faculty of Built Environment. My background's actually anthropology, and I'm here to present on an interdisciplinary project, which was basically testing smart meters and some flexibility products in East London. So I thought, you know, my main interest is talking about households' experiences, but I thought I'd just set the context a little bit around demand-side response and try and engage a bit with the question of of the policy implications, given the interest of the seminar series. So just to start, demand-side response, in simple terms, is trying to ask customers to consume electricity at different times in response to a signal. And if we're able to adjust how people use energy, the time of day, the type of energy, the amount of energy they're using, then we can perhaps answer some sort of critical challenges that are affecting the energy system at the moment. So if we can reduce sort of peaks, then we don't have to have so many big power stations. We can bring more renewable generating sources online, which are hard to optimize at the moment because they're so variable. And we can also perhaps avoid sort of congestion in the secondary stations, so in the sort of the local networks, which are getting overloaded as people consume more at the peak. But if we can spread that peak, perhaps we don't need to invest so much in sort of infrastructure upgrade. So sort of a key rationale behind the smart meter rollout. So the UK is currently trying to put a smart meter in every home by 2020. And the reason being that smart meters, in theory, should provide a better quality data, so more accurate and higher resolution, which allows suppliers to understand more how energy is being used, but also consumers should get an accurate, almost real-time understanding of the energy they're consuming and also what it's costing them at that moment. So if we can enable this kind of dialogue between people, then consumers can become these kind of co-managers of national infrastructure and help us meet these sort of bigger systemic goals to manage our electricity system. I mean, I just put some headlines there just to show that these offers... So when I'm talking about flexibility offers, I'm talking about specifically things like time-of-use tariffs or products that an energy supplier might sell to you, so a tariff or something, in order to get you to shift your consumption, how they want you to shift it. And these things are already appearing in the market. So, you know, you can, if you have a smart meter, you can get what's called a time-of-use tariff, so you can get electricity that the unit price changes according to the time of day. And then it's up to you to try and consume electricity following that schedule at the lowest cost, if that's what you want to do. So those things are on the market, but there's still quite a lot of research to be done, because the government is obviously interested in how smart meters can help improve the energy system, but it's also interested in the distributional impacts of this infrastructural upgrade. And the project that I'm talking about fits into that remit. So the government wants to understand, you know, can fuel-poor and vulnerable households benefit from these kind of products and offerings in the same way that, say, a rich consumer might be able to. So our trial was based in East London in Tower Hamlets, and it offered two types of these flexibility products. And my role on the project was the social research. And as I started, so when we started off in these projects, I started to do some qualitative research. And one of the things that came out quite clearly was that women were responding in a way that seemed to be much more obvious than I had anticipated or expected. So that sort of made me think about the role of women in energy system change. And I just wanted to put that in a sort of bit of a broader perspective, because housewives have been recognised by industry and government before as sort of a core to creating system change. So here you've got an advert from 1916, which is about electrification. So this isn't an appliance, this is a utility trying to convince people to get their houses connected to the electricity system to enable them to roll out the electricity grid. Women were sort of seen as a key way of trying to enable that. And then jump to the 1970s in the UK and the fuel crisis. You had the government brought out a massive advertising campaign, Save It. And that's the badge that Delia Smith, who's a well-known UK TV chef, celebrity, and football team owner, is telling people how to become more fuel efficient in the way that they prepare the family meals, which essentially is by cooking all your meals at once. I think that was her point there. So, you know, the housewife is a key decision maker, and her decisions make impacts that have systemic effects. But this is an ambivalent subject position. So on the one hand, we recognise her, this archetype, as having agency, as having power, but at the same time, it's at the cost, which is the burden of domestic labour. And I've put there a sort of seminal work by Ruth Schwartz Cowan, which is called More Work for Mother. And her point there is she's challenging this narrative that as homes got connected to gas, electricity, water, the burden on women was lightened. You know, they had all these appliances, they could run the housework without having to really lift a finger. And she's challenging that narrative, and she's saying actually what happened was it dramatically reorganised domestic labour for women in three ways. First of all, it increased the amount of domestic labour. More light meant you saw more dirt, you know, more new standards around hygiene and comfort meant there was just more to be done. It removed a whole area of work that was typically done by other members of the household, by husband, men, and by children. And it also redesignated a whole set of chores that were done by domestic servants and made that the role of the housewife. So it wasn't about labour saving, it was about creating more work for mother, is her key point there. So what's the role of the housewife in the smart electricity grid of the future. Well, arguably, she's not there at all. She doesn't exist, which is an argument that's made by Strengers and Nichols. She's sort of replaced by the feminine voice of Alexa, who will seamlessly orchestrate your Internet of Things connected appliances to make sure that you have comfort and convenience seamlessly delivered, and you don't have to worry about when or who does the ironing. So Strengers, in this book, Smart Energy Technologies, she makes the argument that there's some sort of very male-dominated industries that are imagining the smart future and designing the systems and the infrastructure and the products that are going to create it. And the sort of the archetypal consumer that they have in their mind is this figure of resource man. So he's someone who will use technology to optimize his consumption of resources at home for comfort, for carbon, for cost, for whatever. And she points out there's this sort of there's a real disconnect between understanding that sort of way of thinking about the home and how you're using resources in it, and actually the activities that use energy, which is about sort of cooking, cleaning, ironing. Doing chores is not part of the vision of the smart future. And I think Strengers makes what for me is a really key point, that resource man basically will form the boundaries around who or what an energy consumer can or should be. So there's a very normative drive there. And for me, that raises the question, well, what's the impact on women then? Where are we? So that's a question that's not often asked in current research on demand-side response. The role of gender isn't really looked at. There was one trial that was run a few years ago, a massive trial that's quite similar to the one that I'm going to present now, which looked at smart metering technologies, about flexibility products, about sort of, you know, electric vehicle charging, and how you can start to create this smart grid of connected machines to offer flexibility services to the electricity system. And it was quite interested in what households were finding easy or hard to shift in response to the requests from their suppliers via these kind of products. Cooking, you know, is a key contributor to the evening peak because everyone gets home and cooks. But it's a very hard activity to shift because it depends on so many people in the home. You know, you have to be cooking, you've got loads of kids and people to organise to produce the evening meal, to sit down and eat it. And those people's time is dependent not just on them, but they're linked into much broader societal rhythms around the working day and the school day. So big impact, very hard to shift. Conversely, laundry and washing the dishes are much more shiftable because they're typically just something that one person does, and they don't have to worry about when it gets done. You know, they can make a decision. It's like, right, we're going to do it now. Therefore, it's much more flexible. You can sort of think, okay, I'm actually going to do it at 3 a.m. rather than in the evening peak. I mean, the authors of the report just make an aside point that in most cases, these activities are done by a woman, and they don't discuss that further. But for me, I think there's an interesting question to be asked there, given what we know about who carries out the majority of domestic labour in the UK at the moment. So this is from the most recent Time Use survey, which is where people write down what they've been doing hour by hour. And it just shows that 3 of the kind of loads on the electricity system, laundry, housework, cooking, are predominant, you know, but they are, women are doing more of them, spending more time doing these kind of chores than men. So, for me, I think considering this concept of flexibility woman rather than resource man perhaps will help us if we're trying to understand how to design policy and products for the smart energy future. Because I'm just concerned that the gendered nature of domestic electricity consumption isn't being adequately understood or investigated. And that might lead us to overlook some distributional impacts. And create some unintended consequences for women, given that they continue to take on the burden of most domestic labour. So the project that I was involved in that sort of got me asking these questions is called EnergyWise. It's ongoing at the moment. It's Ofgem regulated, so the UK electricity regulator is regulating the project. It's led by a district network operator, so those are the people in charge of down from the grid, local networks, and it's targeting vulnerable and fuel-poor households. So we recruited about 550 households in Tower Hamlets, which was picked because it's one of the more deprived areas in the UK. And we're working with social housing providers, a community outreach organisation, because there's a high proportion of the population there are Bangladeshi and don't speak English, as well as the energy supplier. And the structure, so we had the first trial was a year, which was just a randomised controlled trial where we put a smart meter into one group's homes and we left out the in-home display for the other people to see what the effect was. And we had 530 people on that. And over the year, people moved house or dropped out or changed. And then we started trial two, which is this one about flexibility. And so that's the trial that I'm talking about mainly. And it's ongoing, so we haven't finished it yet. So these are sort of provisional results and just an opportunity to talk through some of the stuff I'm seeing. And what we had, so we had 72 people who were using prepayment meters. So those are the ones that you need to preload money onto. You have a key or you have some sort of system where you have to put the money on before you access the energy. And so we asked them to join up with a critical peak rebate offer. And we had 166 people on credit meters. So that's the more standard where you have an energy bill every month or quarter and you pay after you've consumed the energy for it. And they were offered a time of use trial. So I'll just go through the two offers that we made in a bit more detail. I mean, one of the things to highlight is that these are non-punitive. So it's more typical to offer punitive. So you price the peak high and the off-peak low in order to try and make sure that people don't use peak as much. But because we were working with social housing tenants, we wanted a non-punitive structure. So what we did was actually adapt the energy supplier's offer that was already on the market, which was offering free electricity between 9 to 5 on either Saturday or Sunday, in the hope that if you get free electricity then, you're going to pull some of the consumption out of the evening weekday peak. So that was the structure for the credit meters. So it was a very simple offer. Sign up, we'll give you free electricity on either Saturday or Sunday. And 166 people said yes, 58% of whom were women consented to the project and 42% were men. For the critical peak rebate trial, so this was offered to people who had the prepayment meters, so we couldn't offer them a tariff because they don't have a tariff, they buy in advance, they're prepayment customers. So what we designed was what's called a critical peak rebate. So what that does is we imagine the peak of the evening in some situation turns into a critical peak where there's a possibility of a blackout or some overloading of the network. And so you ask consumers, we need you to reduce your consumption now. And if you're able to do that, we'll give you a reward. So the kind of punitive version is the critical peak. Maybe there isn't. So the incentive that we were offering our households were that if during the period, so we would send them a notification, we'd send them a day before a text saying tomorrow night you're going to have a bonus time, which was the critical peak. So between 5 and 11 we'd like you to use as little electricity as possible and we will reward you 10 times the amount of electricity that you save. So we're asking people to avoid using electricity then. We estimate how much we expected them to use. We calculate what they used during the event. And if they've used less than we thought they were going to, we give them 10 times that amount. And we convert that into pounds and we send it straight as a credit to their prepayment meter. And we got 72 people to say yes, 68% of whom were women and 32% were men. And that's in part because more women-headed households have prepayment meters, which I don't know if everyone's aware, but prepayment meters are the most expensive way to buy energy, electricity. So that sort of made me go back to look at, when I started doing some qualitative research with people to check that they were, because we wanted to check that everyone had understood the offers when we started them, I went out to talk to them. And that was when it became clear to me that it was women who were sort of taking on quite a lot of the work. And that made me go back and just check who'd consented to our project, because we hadn't been monitoring for gender. And so social housing residents, they are skewed towards a more female population. So more social housing providers have more tenancy contracts in women's names than they do in men. And so the people, you know, we approached 1,300 people, 57% of whom were females, and 39% were male. And we got the same amount of people who said yes to our project. So we got 57% of women saying yes versus 39% of men. But over time, that sort of changed, and we've seen a great drop-off of men. So we're now looking at 61% of our participants are female consentees and 38% are male consentees. And I should say that that's the direct opposite ratio of the trial that I mentioned earlier, where they talked about cooking being hard and laundry being easy because it's one person, normally a woman. So that trial was funded by Ofsted. It was a very similar sort of project, but targeting a different population, and they had 60% men and 40% women, targeting a more affluent section of society. So that's who said yes. And so now I just wanted to talk a bit about what people have been doing, you know, what have been the responses to these offers, to the people who said yes. And I wanted to start with Nadia, because in many respects she is the ideal responder. She has an electric cooker, for one. She's got a tumble dryer, so she's got some quite energy-intense loads in her home. And she's a keen responder. And in line with sort of the other research, she's finding laundry the easiest thing to shift. So she's on the critical, she's on bonus time, so she's being asked every so often to reduce her electricity consumption. And she's finding laundry the easiest way of responding to that request. But she works, she's got three kids at home, she's a single parent, and one of her children is university age. And she's actually been able to get her daughter involved in the response. So if she's out at work, she'll text her daughter and say, I was going to do a wash tonight, but there's bonus time. Can you put the wash on this afternoon while you're at home, and then I can take it out? So she's managing to recruit other family members into her housekeeping and management chores. But she also talked about shifting dinner slightly. So that was something that's been identified in research as quite hard to do. But she was saying, we ran an event on a weekend, and she was saying how pleased she was that she'd managed to get the dinner done by 5 o'clock. Might have gone over by 5 or 10 minutes. But her goal was to get it cooked before bonus time started. So she's up there, she's making it work for her. But more than that, there are some sort of other things going on in Nadia's response. So she talks about using the in-home display. So that's a little thing you get that communicates with your smart meter that tells you, right now you're using these many kilowatt hours and it's costing you this much. So she was looking at her in-home display and it was starting to shoot up over 3/4, and she thought to herself, no, something's got to come off. The dryer's got to turn off. I've got to turn the cooker off. So what this is showing, she's sort of building an awareness of the electricity consumption profile of her home and her appliances. So she's building what could be thought of as flexibility capital. So she's gaining the skills and the knowledge to enable her to respond well, efficiently to these kind of flexibility products. She says, I was interviewing her right at the start, so this was before we'd sent her 3-month statement, which explained to her how many credits she'd actually earned during these peak events. So I just want a few credits just to see if I've actually achieved something. So she's conforming very much to the kind of behavioural economics rationale that underpins these kind of products. You know, she's motivated. She knows her action can generate the economic reward. She's responding exactly in the way that the product is designed to make her respond. But more than that, so for the sociologists who reject that kind of behavioural economics description of motivation, she's also making some sort of questioning some normative assumptions. She's saying it makes you think of how you do things in your home. Don't be so obsessed with doing a wash, it can wait. So she's actually asking some broader questions that start to raise, you know, pick apart why she's doing the things that she's doing. Does she really need to do it? So in many cases, the ideal responder. And her response, I mean, you know, a lot of the people I spoke to did come up with these quite creative ways of responding to these products using very low tech. You know, these aren't people who have Alexa running their home. Constance, who is in charge of the housekeeping in terms of budget and consumption, is in a constant battle with her wife and with her husband and her children to get them to be less wasteful. And she's recruited the bonus time product into her strategy of managing the home. You know, she's got a thermos flask so she can make, her husband can make hot drinks during a bonus time period without turning the kettle on and ruining her response to this product. Constance was actually quite an advocate for punitive time of use structures because she thought her family members would really not dare to do things if they knew it was going to cost them more. Carl is on the much simpler free time, so he's just getting free electricity, and discovered that his microwave is also an oven. So he's trying to bake more on a Saturday to take advantage of getting free electricity. So what he is essentially doing is arbitraging between gas and electricity, because he's got a gas oven. And Beatrice is running her electric heater just to dry out a damp bedroom because she hasn't been able to get it fixed any other way. So she's increasing comfort. So for some people, you know, all this is aligning. The stuff they have in the home, the things they need to get done, the comfort that they want, they're making these products work for them. But that's not the case for everyone. And I think these two, Amy and May's experience sort of demonstrate some of the difficulties. So Amy, someone who was on the bonus time, and she explained when she got her first quarterly statement, which says how much money she's earned from responding to our offer, she said she showed her house and her children were, you know, everyone was clapping and praising me. So, you know, there's the potential to validate and reward the effort and skill of household management. That's great. But May's experience, she's a credit meter user. She had the option to say yes to the home energy free time to get free electricity at the weekend, and she said no because she didn't think it would be worth it. And for me, it's a bit of a concern because May is struggling with her bills. Energy bills are a concern to her. She's actually reached out and asked for support from some of the community services provided. She's not an English speaker, so I was interviewing her with a translator. And somehow, she's on her energy supplier's standard variable tariff. That's the most expensive tariff normally that they offer. So no one has communicated to her that by shifting tariffs, changing tariffs, she could probably instantly reduce her energy bills. You know, she's getting an energy bill every month that tells her there's another tariff that would be better for her. And then when I started to speak to her about her weekly routine, she explained to me she's got quite a few kids at home. She tends to do the laundry at the weekends to have it ready for school on a Monday. And, you know, just that past Saturday, she put two loads on. And I was saying to her, well, if you had been on that tariff, that would have been free. So you would have saved, you know, maybe 63p or something, which isn't a lot. But for someone who's struggling with their energy bills, it suggests to me that we haven't been communicating properly. We haven't been talking about these offers in terms of chore doing. And so on the one hand, you know, while, you know, there's the possibility to start paying, you know, to start validating domestic labour, there's also the possibility of ignoring the impact that chores have on the electricity system and just pretending it's not about that. I'm talking to men. So although I did talk to some men who were actively responding, typically those living alone or people who had had conversations with their wives or their mothers who they lived with, and discussed the fact that they were on this kind of product, and that if they moved the time of day they did stuff, they would get some rewards. I also spoke to men who had signed up and not made any changes. And what was quite common was the fact that it was the woman who was in charge of the chore running and the housekeeping, and the man didn't tell her that they were on, that they'd swapped onto this programme. So Al says, you know, we just put on. She cooks her meals when she cooks her meals, and she's in charge. And Mo, you know, and there's a split between the consenting and the chore doing. There's a lack of communication there. And that was also the case in Mo's home. So, you know, he's in charge of the bills. That's his headache. And he wouldn't consider asking his wife to take on that additional task of having to manage the chores, not only do them, but manage them according to a schedule that's going to save money, because it's his responsibility to make sure the money's there to pay the bill. But also, you know, as you say, he's not really interested in earning the credits. It's more about the general awareness of electricity saving. So for him, and actually for Al, electricity saving was about switching off the lights when you're not in the room. And even though they've been involved in our project, we hadn't managed to convey a sense that there were other more energy-intense activities that could be flexed and create sort of system benefits, but also benefits in the home in terms of financial savings. So just this potential to reinforce misperceptions around the electricity system and energy saving. Sorry, am I going over? Oh, sorry. Yeah, and so I think just the key thing, so although, you know, I definitely spoke to men who were responding, it was just I didn't speak to any women where this was an issue, that there was a split between the person who knew what the product was and who was in charge of the household. And looking at the smart meter data, we're only just starting to analyse this, but you can see the distribution of rewards. So, you know, I mean, we're talking very small amounts. On average, people are earning £2 a month from this programme, and they're going it back. But, you know, some people are earning quite a lot more, and they tend to be women, and that is a statistically significant difference, that women consentees tend to be earning more on this programme. So I just sort of wanted to start thinking about some of the implications of this. You know, it just seems to me that a smart meter is going to, might affect the way that chores get done, and that a flexibility product, like the ones we've been offering, sort of depend on it. And I just think this has an impact for how we communicate what's going on and how we design products and policies. And I also think there are some sort of serious gender impacts that we need to consider. You know, what are we asking essentially women to do, and is it fair that we're doing that? I think there are some distributional impacts when we're talking about low-income households particularly. So just some sort of headline points around policy implications for the rollout. You know, that non-punitive offers aren't risk-free. They actually can reinforce misconceptions, and they're not sort of contributing to this idea of flexibility capital. I think unless we can encourage a broader debate about the value that flex domestic labour can have, and start to raise questions about who's burdened with doing that and whether we want an energy system that makes that request. In terms of the gender implications, I mean, there's a slight ambivalence that on the one hand you could say, well, it's raising the status of housekeeping within the home and within society more general. It's perhaps bringing men more into doing some domestic labour. But I think, you know, it also reinforces traditional gender divisions of labour. And it increases the burden on women, I would argue. And when we think about distributional impacts, I mean, you know, how are you accessing the cheaper electricity that these kind of products offer? Is it through Alexa? And if you can't afford Alexa, do you have to become her? Or are you just too poor to access cheap electricity? So I just wanted to end on are we looking for resource man or flexibility woman in the future? And I'd argue, you know, flexibility woman and man exists and is balancing domestic and system demands and can be recruited as co-manager of national energy infrastructure. But we need to think carefully about ignoring her and poorly designing products and policies, but also about the way that we're excluding certain groups from smarter, cheaper energy. So that's my talk. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Charlotte. I had an opportunity to look at a kind of paper version of this beforehand. Some of my comments actually arise out of the language from that, which I don't know, in a sense, how seriously was meant. But I think this work is very important for how we understand demand, and I have to say I like it very much indeed. And it also chimes a little bit with some work that I've been doing on what David might think of as a rather low level, rather than aiming high. I actually rather like to aim low. If I produce high things, there are embarrassing accidents that emerge in the course of doing low things. But looking at changes in domestic fuel choices in Sweden, some work I've been doing with Magnus Lindmark, and there we actually find that a very important factor is female participation in the labour market, determining the opportunity cost of their time, and then that having kind of ramifications for investment in particular heating technology in particular, but also cooking. So I think, you know, this is highlighting something that hasn't been given enough attention and is a major issue. I mean, actually, as you highlighted in the paper, it's been thought of a lot more in things we've discussed in this seminar about use of, for example, more efficient stoves in India or in sort of context in the global south, but not so much in Britain or Western Europe or North America. And I think it highlights that, you know, a really essential factor in thinking about demand is the opportunity cost of time. Again, that's something that's come up for people before. And I mean, your message at the end, actually, Charlotte, is quite ambivalent about this approach and the possible costs and benefits of it. And I think a danger, certainly in the current assumptions about the how we might steer people's behaviour through a sort of behavioural economics approach, is in the end, we're not taking into account the opportunity cost of time from the point of view of the people in the household, and particularly women. And there's a great danger in assuming that the changes rely on things that seem to be trivial, perhaps to resource man, you know, shifting the time of cooking dinner by half an hour, but actually it might have a very major opportunity cost, which is invisible to the person who has to cook the dinner. And therefore, actually, judgments that people might make that might seem conservative, I don't say it's the case necessarily the one you highlighted, Charlotte, but where people say, I didn't think it would be worth it. Well, one has to, you know, take seriously how they establish worth in each particular case. And I did wonder, actually, whether this was also, wonder if you could say a bit more whether you think perceptions here were shaped by the fact that these people had prepayment meters. That did strike me as an issue. They might think actually very differently about the costs that they're facing and how that's kind of factored into their payment cycles over the year. It does seem to me that one of the issues actually about energy costs is, you know, people are much more conscious of energy as being a burden on them, on their household costs, in a way that they may not be with other things that seems quite strange, and it's because of the manner in which they pay the bills. So that might have an important aspect as well. I would like actually to hear Charlotte say a little bit more from the perspective of an interdisciplinary seminar on actually the way that her own project has been framed. I mean, Charlotte's had quite a diverse and interesting background herself, but it does seem to me that actually a lot of the drive behind these types of policies is still coming from actually quite fundamentally top-down questions being framed in terms of economics and the principles of economics. And actually I wanted to highlight a particular sentence within the written paper, which was actually in relation to the work of Stengers, where it was pointing out that people's actually lived lives operated as a powerful constraint on the agency of the individual to act on a purely economic signal. And that being presented as a problem, rather than thinking, well, why is the design of the energy system not actually being designed around the preferences that people already have in their daily lives, rather than thinking that that has to be managed and it's a kind of problematic way. And this actually struck me quite powerfully in thinking about the ideal responder. I'm probably not being the ideal responder here, but Nadia, you're saying, you know, questioning her norms. So she shouldn't be so obsessed with something that seemed really important to her and she cared about is now appearing as a something of a trivial obsession, the wash, relative to saving possibly actually a very small amount of money from her energy bill. And I wonder about the actual ethics of that framing, or at least how it will play out in different households as a distributional issue, as you highlight. Another phrase, actually, I mean, a couple of things, again, in the terminology, which is comes back to, I wonder what you think about this in an interdisciplinary perspective. Towards the end, you talked about consumers potentially being co-managers of the national energy infrastructure. And I don't know whether this is your phrase or something that's used more generally. I think it's someone else's. And I thought, well, yeah, for example, moving my pension scheme from being a defined benefit one to another type might be making me a co-manager of my pension fund, but in a way that I don't necessarily feel to be entirely desirable. And one wonders where actually the serious managerial decisions in this framework are really being made. And that's also actually with the issue of flexibility, which I think you rightly highlighted as being kind of you know, not necessarily always having positive connotations. It could be a demand on certain people who actually also do have to live quite flexible lives, but them to be even more flexible and putting burdens upon them. I have to say, actually, when we get a thing in economic history that's emerged recently is patience capital, and I really don't know how that differs from patience. Flexibility capital. I think if we, from an interdisciplinary perspective, if we start to use these terms, they originate as metaphors, but of course they appear because people can then put them as parameters into equations. And I think if the language becomes dominated by that notion of modelling behaviour, is that something, as an interdisciplinary group, what we see as desirable? Or what direction does it push us in? But also in thinking about flexibility is one of those words that generally seems as virtuous, and I think in some ways the whole idea of demand response and using smart meters is predicated upon that. But particularly in the arena of households, it may be that a lack of flexibility is actually there for a good reason, because being flexible actually introduces all sorts of costs and problems in households. And this actually made me think of some work I've done in a rather parallel life, but thinking about peasant behavior, both in the terms of allocating goods that are produced by men and women and children within peasant households, and also actually thinking about how village communities manage their common property, where from an optimizing point of view, you can think some of the decisions are quite strange, and particularly why, for example, there's been a lot of studies done by anthropologists in West Africa showing that crops that are traditionally produced by men seem to be either marketed or retained as a hedge against famine, without reference to other crops that are being produced by women, and there might be a better way to get around this. But the argument actually is that if all the time, and contingent on external market and weather circumstances, you constantly had to negotiate with your partner what you were doing with the things you normally managed, it becomes an incredible burden upon households and causes actually all sorts of stress and tension. So there's a very strong argument in favor, in the sense of kind of ritual and habit as a way of managing life. Now, of course, those rituals and habits themselves might entail an unequal distribution of authority, but they can also argue to be beneficial. And so, you know, having to engage with the smart meter all the time might actually cause problems in many arrangements. And so the arrangements seen from a certain type of viewpoint might make a lot of sense. Although one might want to question, indeed, why we have certain divisions of labor between the genders and so forth in the first place and in that context. So it seems to me that we have to think actually quite seriously about the desirability of flexibility and the issue of, you know, constant response to the signals that are coming down to people. And also actually not only to differentiate between men and women, but it's very important to highlight that you do seem to get, you know, such strongly differentiated attitudes in the sample that you've looked at, but that the population as a whole is differentiated in all sorts of different ways. And actually there are some people, whether male or female, who will like the gaming aspect of it, who will like the joy of flex, but there are other people who will like the joy of repetition and habit, actually, and that will be very important to the ways that they manage their lives. And of course that might also vary quite significantly over the life cycle as well. And in regard to that as well, as a kind of general strategy, I mean, you pointed out in the end that in these test cases, partly because to get people involved, you didn't want to be penalising them in any way, the amounts of savings that they could accrue were relatively small. Now, it seems to me, although I'm guessing, that in the broader economics, it's only really like to make a significant difference to the profile of demand if people are actually hurt by making decisions that to the system as a whole seem erroneous ones. So when you get to the level of differential pricing where it actually hurts, or in a sense it hurts to step out of line, and then what kind of tensions that could introduce to the household seems quite a difficult issue, actually. What level would we be prepared to set that at? So those are my comments. Thank you.